My name is Dan Spencer, and this is session number 5 in the week-long series on gay and Christian. And before we start and go into the session, I just want to thank everybody for this week. It has been a real gift to me. I've really enjoyed it, and especially all the kinds of conversations I've had in between the sessions here. The warmth and hospitality of this community, my being here, has been very moving. So I very much appreciate all the conversations I've had with many of you, and regret the ones I didn't have with many of you for lack of time, and there's so many of us here, but thank you for that. The topic today is called Homophobia, the Church, and AIDS. I guess I've been putting into perspective what we've been doing all week. The first session looked at the experience of being gay and Christian, what that's like. The second session looked more at spirituality of our faith and how gay and lesbian Christians express that, especially focusing on a creation-centered spirituality. Sessions 4 and 5 looked at the question of the Bible. And today is going to be more a question of looking at discrimination against gay men and lesbians and how the church can respond to that as a justice issue, focusing particularly on the phenomenon of homophobia, which I'll define in a minute. But I'd like to start with a couple stories or parables, whatever. One of the ways that any group that is discriminated against or the minority group deals with that, there are several different ways we respond to that, the experience of being oppressed or discriminated. Sometimes anger, sometimes fear. But one of the ways that's been very helpful as a survival mechanism has also been humor. And while homophobia is anything that but humorous, there are ways that we deal with the effects of homophobia within our community through humor, as well as some of the other manifestations. This first little parable, I think it is kind of a fun little parable, and it has nothing, not exclusively to do with the gay and lesbian situation, but it's called the Parable of Ups and Downs. What makes an up an up and a down is that an up can do more to a down than a down can do to an up. That's what keeps an up and a down. The ups tend to talk to each other and study the downs, asking the downs about what's up or what's coming down for that matter. The downs spend a lot of time taking the ups out to lunch, to dinner, to explain their downness. The ups listen attentively, often in amazement about the experience of being down. They contrast one down's experience with another down's experience, and at times don't worry too much about what the downs are up to because the downs never get together. If they did, the ups would have to shape up. After a while, the downs weary of talking to the ups. They tire of explaining and justifying their downness. They think, if I have to explain my downness one more time, I'll throw up. And so they form a process which they call networking and support groups. This act makes the ups nervous. Three ups together is a board meeting, three downs pre-revolutionary activity. Some ups hire downs, dress them up, send them down to see what the downs are up to. We sometimes call this personnel and affirmative action. This creates a serious problem for the down, who is dressed up with no sure place to go. That down doesn't know whether he or she is up or down. That's why downs in the middle often burn out. Sometimes what the ups do to smarten up is to ask the downs to come into a program one at a time to explain their downness. The ups call this human relations training. Of course, the ups never have to explain their upness. That's why they're ups rather than downs. Now, there's good news and bad news in the parable. The good news is we're all both ups and downs. There's no such thing as a perfect up, nor a perfect down. The bad news is that when we're up, it often makes us stupid. That's called dumb upness. It's not because ups are not smart, it's that ups don't have to pay attention to downs the way downs have to pay attention to ups. Downs always have to figure out what the ups are up to. The only time ups worry about downs is when downs get uppity, at which time they put them down by the ups. The ups' perception is the downs are overly sensitive, they have an attitude problem. It is never understood that the ups are underly sensitive and have an attitude problem. I used to think that when the downs became ups, they would carry over their insight from their downness to their upness. Not so. Smart down, dumb up. The second thing I want to start with is in the form that I got it, is entitled a Gay and Lesbian World Fantasy. What it is and we often do this in the gay and lesbian community, talk about what would it be like if the roles were completely reversed and we found ourselves in the majority with all the different manifestations. I hope you enjoy this as well. If you're heterosexual, I hope it'll help you get some insights into what it's like to be a part of the minority perspective. If you're homosexual, I hope you'll just enjoy it in terms of the fantasy of what it would be like if if we were in the majority. Listen to this, though, in terms of what it might mean about homophobia, which we'll talk about in a minute. Imagine there's a nonviolent coup by militant gay activists tomorrow. This coup is backed by all branches of the military, which have been infiltrated by closeted homosexuals. But the rules of life have now changed profoundly. An announcement is made that homosexuality is God's choice of normal sexual behavior. Oblique biblical references are cited to uphold this. TV evangelists rail at the perversity of heterosexuality as they repent their past sins. In the popular press, homosexuality is associated with the golden age of Greece, the strength and progress of the Roman Empire, and the creativity of the Renaissance. Heterosexuality is associated with selfishness, depravity, and world war. Adolf Hitler is used as an example of heterosexuality taken to its ultimate destructive course. History books are rewritten to underscore the contributions of lesbians and gay men. The homosexuality of such figures as Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, and Socrates is highlighted as a reflection of their emotional maturity and psychological advancement. Contributions of heterosexual historical figures are minimized, and if it is necessary to mention them, there is no reference to their heterosexuality or marital status. Health texts and psychiatric literature are rewritten to reflect the belief that homosexuality is a natural endpoint of a healthy development progression. Heterosexuality is said to be due to an inability to form a trusting relationship with the same-sex parents, leading to feelings of contempt for the self and a need to focus energy on sexual acting out with someone of the opposite sex, with whom true intimacy is impossible. Many gays and lesbians equate heterosexual feelings only with lust and consider these feelings a sin. People understand that gay relationships are based on mutual understanding and friendship, as well as sexual love, while heterosexuality is often associated with sexual exploitation, such as children and rape. Adolescents are placed in same-sex boarding school to discourage heterosexual tendencies. If mixed-gender friendships appear to take precedence over normal homosexual relationships, they are broken up. Only homosexuals are allowed in the nation's schools as teachers or administrators. Bands of gay teenagers prowl the streets and parks of large cities, preying on heterosexual couples who come there to meet. Beatings are rarely prosecuted, though, since heterosexual behavior is against the law, and suspected heterosexuals are the subject of job, housing, and financial discrimination.
Some hardline psychiatrists and psychologists believe that all heterosexuals are borderline personality disorders or narcissistic and antisocial. People displaying ego-dystonic heterosexual tendencies are viewed as suffering from a psychiatric disturbance. Psychoanalytic approaches are often used in treatment to uncover the developmental trauma associated with heterosexual fixation. Behavior therapists point out the lack of proven effectiveness of the analytic approach. They develop aversive techniques that pair electric shock with heterosexual arousal and construct reinforcement schedules for progressive homosexual behavior. Teenagers with heterosexual conflicts have a triple suicide rate. Children are commonly heard on playgrounds playing games like Stomp the Straights and Bash the Breeders. Civil libertarians attempt to pass legislation making hate crimes against racial minorities and heterosexuals a criminal offense, but the bill is met with ridicule and contempt in the state legislature, where rural gay and lesbian members state that heterosexuals are sinners who should not enjoy special legal protection. An effort is made to dilute the proposed legislation by attaching amendments protecting members of various gay and lesbian political lobby groups, much to the amusement of many legislators. The bill is withdrawn prior to a vote. The movie industry imposes a period of self-censorship lasting for several decades. During this period, any heterosexual characters included in the script must be portrayed negatively. Most federal research money is now allotted to the AIDS issue, while programs funding cancer, heart disease, and neurological desires such as MS and CP are severely cut. These diseases are considered low priorities as they are not contagious and they pose less threat to people in the prime years of life. There is no heterosexual content on billboards, magazines, TV ads, TV shows, on the radio, in records, school textbooks. Expressions of gay and lesbian sexuality is rampant. Billboards feature scantily dressed gay men gazing fondly at lumberjacks to sell a variety of projects. TV ads show lesbians in high-top tennis shoes, crew cuts, and ear clips controlling corporate boards and then cut to these women at home with their girlfriends who use a certain type of shampoo. Radical heterosexual rights groups emerge in a few large cities. Women in these groups insist on adopting a costume featuring high heels, makeup, and short skirts. Sometimes these women can successfully negotiate their way in large cities, dancing and socializing with male friends, as they are often mistaken for male transvestites, who display a healthy level of gender flexibility. However, if these heterosexual women are discovered, they are ridiculed, beaten, or taunted as perverts. Well, the list could go on and on, but here's a description of some of the aspects of the world. Before we go on, let me just ask you how that sounds to you. How would you react to a world like that? Or how do you respond to the fantasy? What feelings does it evoke?
Well, it seems totally absurd that kind of prejudice and discrimination could go on in that setting, but then, of course, you flip it around and see that it goes on right now.
It does, the fantasy does seem absurd, you know, in terms of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
It brings out how much we, as heterosexuals, have done to the gay and lesbian community.
Well, I think the point is just in terms of keeping track of how you felt during that, whether you felt angry. I know some people react very angrily to this. Other people feel very sad. Other people feel very excluded and hurt. The point to keep in mind is that's pretty much the experience of most lesbians and gay men in our world. Each one of these points, obviously, has just been taking a feature of our world and flipping it around to give you an idea of how total our exclusion from the predominant forms of society is. And it's always very interesting to me because one of the responses to gay and lesbian people when we come out of the closet is don't flaunt it. Don't be so blatant about it. And I think that people who make comments like that have very little idea how blatant the heterosexual nature of our society is. And so sometimes just reading through something, as you said, as absurd as this, but is compounding in each area of life, you begin to see how much society is structured around a heterosexual norm that doesn't even allow the inclusion for homosexual people in that.
Yeah. That's just saying, by posing the choice in the way you do, you make it seem just purely arbitrary and that extent absurd that the way things are now would obtain rather than the reversal, the mere reversal of that. But, I mean, if you think about it, it's not merely arbitrary that heterosexuals outnumber homosexuals, and that a lot of the things that you're pointing, some of them I would agree are unjust or should be reformed, but on the whole it's not purely arbitrary that heterosexuals outnumber homosexuals, since that is, heterosexual activity is the way that the species reproduces. And so there is a reason for it. You know, homosexuals could never outnumber.
Sure, but does a simple majority also justify then active oppression and repression? I mean, I think your reaction is probably the reaction of many people who experience life heterosexually. From my perspective as a homosexual person, it's totally absurd. Every single one of these points I would go through and argue for the absurdity for, because they do seem arbitrary to me. That's what we want to focus on today, and that's what we'll get into the discussion. I'm only trying to point out that not so much whether this is right or wrong, but if you're reacting that it seems arbitrary and absurd, just know that's how most homosexual people react to our world. To us, it does seem arbitrary and absurd. Rightly or wrongly, that's how we experience it, and the exclusion we feel in that. And so it's more just a chance for you to get in touch a little bit with what it feels like to be gay or lesbian in this world. Now, we can obviously go through in each one and talk about whether there's a justifiable reason for structuring it that way, and there are good arguments on many sides of the issue. The point is here mostly, though, to help you identify with what it feels like to be gay or lesbian in our society. What I want to focus on, actually, though, is the phenomenon that justifies this, which has been described or labeled homophobia. It's been coined in various different ways, and it's actually, the term homophobia is a misnomer in the way it's used. If you literally, homophobia means fear of the same, rather than fear. A more accurate term would be something like homosexual phobia, fear of the same sex. But homophobia is the term that has been adopted, and it simply means the non-rational, the irrational fear of same-sex orientation or attraction. Then the behaviors that come out of this fear. Before I go any further, though, let me mention one thing. Homophobia is a descriptive term. It's not meant to cast scapegoats. It's not meant to point fingers. It's something that all of us are having socialized into us, whether we are lesbian, gay, or heterosexual. All of us in this society have homophobic attitudes ingrained in us because they're very part of the fabric of our society itself. It's much the same way that people are recognizing the whole problem of things such as sexism and racism. It's not anybody's fault individually. It's a societal thing that has been bred into us. What we need to do, though, is to learn to recognize it and to see where the destructive tendencies may lie. Homophobia or people who've studied that have said that it comes out of a system what has been labeled as heterosexism, that homophobia is one of the beliefs that comes out of a system which defines heterosexuality as either the superior or the only norm for structuring society. And if you can get a sense of what that's like in terms of the absurdity, if we had homosexism of structuring society exclusively around a homosexual norm, we would probably come up with something like we did in the fantasy there. But the idea that society is structured around the belief that heterosexuality is either the exclusively acceptable norm or the morally superior norm, and other forms are inferior. Homophobia, then, is one of the mechanisms that's used to justify and maintain a society built on heterosexism. What I'd like to do in this time is to go through a little bit to help us recognize some of the forms that homophobia takes, some of the behavioral responses that come out of that, some of the variables involved in homophobia, where it comes from, and then to suggest some ways the church might respond to homophobia, I'll maintain as a justice issue, although we can certainly discuss that. Homophobia, if we define it as the fear of same-sex orientation or attraction, takes place in many forms. One of the predominant forms, and encourage you, as I mentioned each one of these, to think about your own life or your own experiences and see if you can identify ways in your own life or experiences you have with other people that might illustrate this. One of the common forms is the fear of being thought to be homosexual by other people, having other people think you might be homosexual. And some examples of this I can think of. I know that there are, certainly for gay and lesbian people, that's a very strong fear early on for us. And for example, if we want to go into a library and find out about who we are, very frightening to go to the library and say, excuse me, ma'am, could you tell me where the books are on homosexuality? Or to go into a bookstore and buy the book to take it up to the counter. If you've ever had the experience when you've been reading about homosexuality and you have a book that, you know, has homosexual on the cover and you're reading along and all of a sudden someone else is coming down the aisle and you kind of quickly slip it into here. So now you're not reading about homosexuality, you're reading about embodiment or something else. That's an example of a behavior that's being dictated by homophobia, the fear of other people thinking we might be homosexual and the negative repercussions that can come from that. Other forms I'm sure you can all identify are same-gender friendships. We're oftentimes afraid to express feelings of affection for friends who have the same gender, either physically or emotionally, because people might think we're homosexual. And so we distance ourselves to a, quote, safe distance or appropriate distance to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Especially if the other person is openly gay or lesbian.
Particularly if the other person is openly gay or lesbian, and that oftentimes it's not even so much expressing any friendship, it may even be seen in public. In that can be a very uncomfortable experience.
I've noticed that with our young boys. You know, they're 14 now, but even at 9 and 10, they were just bonding as brothers because we adopted at 9, and there was a real lot of push for them not to be couples. And the neighbors had names for that, to call them names. If they should hold hands.
There are responses we learn very, very early.
Really,
if you think of your experiences on the playground, I don't remember how young I was the first time I heard terms like fag or queer or homo, but they happen very quickly as a means of as insulting kids, and kids very quickly learn which behaviors are acceptable and which are not for fear of being labeled a homosexual. Another related to this is the fear that that one might have a homosexual response within oneself. That this, I think, happens again oftentimes in same-gender friendships. Oftentimes with our friends, we experience levels of intimacy that are very deep, and but can be very frightening because we may begin to think, does this mean that I might be homosexual, or that part of me is homosexual, or am I responding, am I sexually attracted to this friend even though my predominant nature is heterosexual? And so again, we respond out of fear and distance ourselves because of the fear of there of being a potential homosexual response. One of the more prevalent ones, at least in the sort of the popular level, is the fear of catching homosexuality. And we laugh about it because it sounds absurd on the face of it, but it's a very powerful force in our society. This whole notion that somehow homosexuality is contagious, and if you are exposed to a homosexual or get near a homosexual or, God forbid, touch a homosexual, it might be contagious. It's very much related to the next one, which is the fear that children will choose to be homosexual if they're exposed to it. If children are even allowed to acknowledge that homosexuality exists or see someone who is homosexual, very great fear that that may somehow seduce or sway the child to become homosexual. And so it borders both on the line. It's an interesting combination of seeing homosexuality as somehow a very powerful, seductive, appealing, but very repugnant and repulsive thing. At the same time, I think it also is very interesting in the way it betrays a very lack of confidence in heterosexuality. That somehow just letting people see it exists will provide a model that is so compelling people will run away from heterosexuality to become homosexual, particularly children. And so we have a lot of our societal sanctions about protecting children from homosexuals are rooted in the fear that either it's contagious or the children will be, by being exposed to it, might be more likely to become homosexual themselves. And I put this in the level of a non-rational fear because all of the society, the social studies show that to be false. So when you look at sort of the objective social studies into that area, there's no basis for that. And therefore, it puts it in the level of a non-rational fear. It's not one that's based in reason. Homophobia is also a very powerful influence for lesbians and gay men. We also experience homophobia, sometimes in different ways, sometimes in similar ways to heterosexual people. But one of the most destructive things for our community is the way we've internalized homophobia as a form of self-hatred. We grew up with all the same messages that everyone else does about how dirty and negative and filthy and lustful and idolatrous and everything else homosexuals are. And we make an identification of ourselves with all of those things. If you were in the Bible study when we went through Romans yesterday, I read through that list of all of the different things in Romans that Paul is claiming was taking place at that time. Take every one of those, and that's what we've learned about ourselves. And so for me now, I come back and I read Romans, and it's very hard for me to identify with that. I don't see myself in the list of all those vices. But we grow up with that, being associated with ourselves. And this takes oftentimes and causes very destructive behavior in the gay and lesbian community, when we haven't dealt with our own self-hatred that has been ingrained in us. Such things as very high alcoholism rates, suicide rates, inability to form a lasting relationship or an intimate relationship. I think oftentimes they're all manifestations of the messages that we've gotten about and that we internalize into self-hatred. In addition to these different attitudes, there are a number of responses that come out societally from homophobia. I'll just mention a few of them here, and they categorize them in some different ways. One is what's been called the dangerous repressive response. This works from an assumption that homosexuals are dangerous to the fabric of society. And starting from that given, that they are dangerous, we therefore becomes the obligation or the duty of society to either contain them or more actively repress them. And we see many different manifestations of this. The society needing to, for example, exclude gay people from housing or for jobs. For some reason, it's dangerous to have gay people living in the same apartment complex as you, and therefore they might molest the children, for example, or they might bring disease with them. Many of these different assumptions that somehow homosexuals are dangerous and therefore we exclude them from our churches and from our apartments and from our country clubs and social gatherings as well as from our occupations. That homosexual people are dangerous to children, therefore they cannot be teachers. So starting with the assumption that they are dangerous, we then move into an active area of repression, and much of society has used that assumption to exclude gay people from it. Connected with this, and oftentimes judging or justifying that, has been what's been called moral reprobation. The whole idea that homosexuals are sinful or immoral, and therefore must need to be excluded. As I mentioned, this has been used oftentimes to justify the other, more active repression, but the idea that the gay and lesbian people are sinful or immoral has been used in many different areas for us to be excluded. Most recent example, I think, is that in the church is the whole question of ordination. The church is getting to the point now where it's in many of the mainline denominations is saying the orientation is not sinful, but acting on it is. And so any expression of our homosexuality actively, is particularly in the sexual area, is thought to be sinful and immoral and therefore proscribed. It's very difficult for those of us who are homosexual to start to know how to make such a sharp distinction. Does that rule out a back rub, which can be a very sexual, intimate act? Does it rule out kissing? Is it only genital contact? At what point do we stop being sexual beings so we're allowed to be homosexual in orientation but not in the way we live? And so it puts us in some very ambiguous situations. But it's justified by an attitude that we are sinful and immoral, therefore need to be either contained or excluded. Another response to homophobia is in the whole area of stereotypes, that all gay men are effeminate and have limp wrists, and all lesbians are tough and masculine and like to wear leather and ride motorcycles. And, you know, like all stereotypes, there usually is an element of truth somewhere in a stereotype. That's why stereotypes have power over us, because we can recognize something in them and therefore we expand that to cover everything. But just as there are some gay men who are feminine, there are others who are not. There are heterosexual men who are feminine and there are others who are not. The same as women in terms of being what we call masculine behavior versus feminine behavior. The point is that stereotypes are what becomes destructive about them is they're used as a mechanism of control. They're used to create fear, they're used to exclude people, they're used to control people, and they're used to moderate behavior. And I think if you think back on your own childhood, think about the ways that young boys who are going through adolescence who may not have been quite as manly or masculine as the societal norm would say, and the very vicious kind of pansy, fag, homo, queer, girl, sissy kind of labeling that gets labeled on them. This gets transferred then to the being homosexual and is used as a mechanism of fear and control to exclude us. I'm just going to go through these a few more things and then we'll have a lot of time to talk about them afterwards, but I want to get through some of the categories here. Another area then is the kinds of behaviors that develop out of these responses and attitudes of how we respond to or out of homophobia. One of the first ones, I think, is simply the whole phenomenon of distancing or avoiding people. That once we know someone is gay or lesbian or suspect they are gay or lesbian, we oftentimes very subconsciously or unconsciously begin to distance ourselves or avoid them. And they've done some very interesting social studies that have borne this out. I'll just mention a couple here that were very interesting. There was a research effort done at Ball State University which sought to discover whether people would not only devalue the gay person, think less of them, but actually actively avoid their company. What they did in this experiment was that subjects who had participated in a laboratory game with an imaginary partner who was believed by the subjects to be real in an adjoining room. At the end of the game, half of the people were told that the partner was gay and half of the people were told that the partner was heterosexual. In the overwhelming number of cases, when they were told the partner was heterosexual, they were given the option of whether they would like to meet this person or not. And when they knew that the person was heterosexual, overwhelmingly chose to meet them after they'd had this conversation. When they were told that the person was homosexual, overwhelmingly chose not to meet them. And in many cases saying that, well, I don't have anything against homosexuals, I don't think I'll meet them. But in exact same circumstances, in one case they distanced or avoided meeting the person, coming in contact. In the other case, when they thought the person was heterosexual, went ahead and met them. This is one of the real fears that we as lesbians and gay men have about coming out of the closet. The fear is that the people particularly who love us best will avoid us or distance themselves from us. And all too often that has turned out to be the case, very painful for us and for those who love us who no longer have an intimate relationship with us. But we see it in a lot of different ways. It's been very interesting for me to compare my experience at Holden Village this time from 2 years ago. 2 years ago, there was a group of Christians in the community from a fairly conservative community, and they were very angry that I was here and talking about the things I was doing. And so none of them would come to the sessions, to listen to the sessions. And I noticed that when off to the village, they would turn their back to me or not talk to me or move away. So there was a very active physical distancing that I experienced. It was very difficult to be here. In contrast, I have not experienced that at all. This time here, it's been very dramatic a difference for me. But avoiding and distancing is not only a physical mechanism, it takes place mentally, emotionally as well. Oftentimes, I've experienced this, and many of my friends who are lesbian or gay experience that some of our close friends, who have been very close friends or heterosexual, begin to distance themselves in the friendship, not even recognizing that they're doing it oftentimes. But the friendships grow distant. And it's oftentimes, again, a response out of homophobia, a fear that hasn't been explored and confronted. A second one that I alluded to before is the whole process of discounting or devaluing a person because they're lesbian or gay. This is one of the experiences, again, I'll speak personally, that I find very difficult about leading the Bible studies on on homosexuality, because oftentimes people's response is not to listen to what I'm saying, but say, well, of course he's going to say that, he's homosexual, as if that then somehow legitimizes discounting what I have to say. We focus on who the person is rather than what the content is of the person presenting, and that in turn justifies what we're doing. This takes place in a lot of different areas of life. Again, I'll just cite one other social study that I think was very interesting on this. There was a woman, a professor at San Diego, who did an interesting experience. She made a videotape of what was allegedly a counseling session between a therapist and a woman in counseling, a female client. And the tape was then screened for more than 100 students who were preparing for professional work in therapy. Before the screening, all the students had been given a lengthy clinical history on the client, and then they watched the tape. Half of those written histories advised the reader that the client was lesbian. The other remaining subjects were led to believe that the client was heterosexual. All of the other information provided in the histories was identical, so the only variable was the sexual orientation. The differences were not only statistically significant, but dramatic. For those subjects of the experiment who understood the client in the film to be lesbian, she was seen as more defensive, less nurturing, less autonomous, less self-confident, and clinically ill than the person who thought to be heterosexual. In contrast, it says, so positive were the subject's reactions to the heterosexually labeled client that many professed puzzlement that she was even in therapy in the first place. Again, they're given an equal standard, but simply the label of being lesbian causes people to devalue, or de-affirm is not a good word, but to, you know, discount the person based on nothing more, no objective evidence, simply the label, brings in our own attitude to devalue the person. Again, that's another very real fear that we as lesbians and gay men have about coming out of the closet. Nobody wants to be devalued for who we are, not what we're doing. And it's a risk that we take when we come out of the closet, that people will think less of us. A third behavior that comes out of homophobia is the whole realm of scapegoating. And the flip side of that would be blaming the victim. That somehow that we brought this upon ourselves and we deserve whatever we get for it. And this has caused tremendous problems in the gay community, particularly, for example, things like reporting anti-gay crime. I think it's a very similar response to what women who've experienced rape go through. That oftentimes we find that rather than people who will look out for our interests, the police and the law authorities ridicule us further and say, well, if you hadn't been wearing those clothes, if you hadn't been sitting on that park bench, if you hadn't then holding hands with him, it wouldn't happen to you. And so instead of finding people that will uphold our interests when we've suffered from homophobia, we're further ridiculed. And this has brought a lot of different problems with it. But the whole notion of blaming the victim is something about the person makes them into a scapegoat that then justifies whatever happens to them. You know, this one is commonly tied up with that whole thing of just don't flaunt it, just don't be blatant about it. For example, there's something so offensive about two men holding hands that it justifies them being beat up, in some cases killed. And that's like that kind of scapegoating and blaming the victim that oftentimes comes out of the deeper lying fear of same-sex orientation. This leads into the fourth behavior I'll mention, which is active aggression or anti-gay violence. In the studies that they show, I forget what the exact statistics are, but something about 40% of all openly gay men report at least one incident of physical abuse against them, and over 90% report at least one incident of verbal abuse. For lesbians, there are similar kinds of studies. Anti-gay violence for us is a fact of our life. We live in a society that is violently opposed to us and expresses that physically. And so the rates, and unfortunately the rates of anti-gay violence are on the increase. I think probably tied to the whole fear and the fear about AIDS, and also the fear that as more and more gay and lesbian people come out of the closet, this is getting more and more spreading for people. But the incidents that are on an increase in society, and this is probably the homophobia taking to the extreme, that somehow this fear justifies beating up or killing gay and lesbian people. I know in my city, in Minneapolis, we sort of like to think, you know, Minnesota is a land that has no problems, there's no such thing as racism in Minnesota, and so forth and so on. Well, there have been a whole series of murders of gay men in the last couple of years there. Don't get the headlines. The only place you tend to see it reported is in the gay newspapers. But a series of men who've been murdered for the simple fact that they're gay. And so that's, again, when you think about what we face when we come out of the closet. That's another risk. It's a very real risk that at some point in our lives we'll be beat up, if not seriously harmed, and certainly in our lives we're going to be verbally abused. Again, a behavior stemming from homophobia. Now that I've outlined that, let's step back just a minute and take a look at what are the variables that are in that help define homophobia. Where does homophobia come from? Social scientists have actually studied the phenomenon of homophobia to try and understand better why some people are more homophobic and other people are less homophobic. And they've been able to divide it to get a series of characteristics to show where this comes from. One of the most important characteristics that distinguishes people who have a low level of homophobia from those who have a high level is people who are highly homophobic will maintain that they have never met a homosexual. And in their mind, they never have. Of course, what we realize with the widespread prevalence of homosexual people in the population is they've never met someone that they knew was homosexual. But in their minds, homosexuality in their world doesn't exist, but something exists out there. We see this is the exact same phenomenon that takes place in racism. When people say, I've never met a black person. I'm not prejudiced against blacks, I've just never met a black person. Or we see it similar in ageism. People who don't have sustained contact with elderly people are oftentimes more likely to have prejudicial attitudes against elderly people. Same thing for lesbian gay people. I remember just I thought an interesting point, if you remember the forum the other night, and we were discussing the different points. Almost everybody who was at point four, which was the more unqualified acceptance, had significant contact with lesbian gay people. And that had in turn shaped their lowering of their anxiety or fear level about responding to it. A second factor or variable involved in homophobia is people who tend to be either highly dogmatic or have a low tolerance for ambiguity tend to be homophobic. I think, and this is again not a means pointing fingers, but more just noting a societal phenomenon. If you look at the churches, the fundamentalist churches, which tend to be fairly rigidly defined in their beliefs and very low tolerance for deviating from that or ambiguity, there's a very high level of homophobia in those communities. People for whom it's very threatening to admit something besides one main norm, which they build their lives around. And the minute people begin to let ambiguity or tolerate diversity into their lives, levels of homophobia tend to drop dramatically. A third area is the whole area of what's been called sex role rigidity. This is the idea that men are men and women are women, and men have men's work to do and women have women's work to do, and that they shouldn't cross them over. There's a real connection here between heterosexism and sexism. This same kind of belief is used to keep women, quote, in their place. It's also used to keep gay men and lesbians, quote, in their place, in this case, the closet. What's in the root here is a confusion between two different concepts and a misidentification. One of gender identity. The idea is the sense that each gender has their own identity that they should play out. That then is equated with sexual orientation. And there's oftentimes, if there are men, for example, who aren't doing manly things, then there's oftentimes an association that means they can't be heterosexual, therefore they must be homosexual. Similarly, women who do typically masculine things. It doesn't fit into our stereotype of what women should be, therefore that they're not heterosexual women, they must be homosexual women. And so we see this a lot of times with, for example, in the area of careers or jobs. Jobs that are thought to be men's jobs or women's jobs. Nurses, for example, a man who is a nurse oftentimes has his sexuality questioned. A woman who is a construction worker is oftentimes not thought to be a real woman and has her sexuality questioned. And it's this identification between what's appropriate to do as your gender and the sexual orientation. And they have nothing in common. There are female construction workers who are heterosexual and homosexual, just as there are male nurses who are homosexual and heterosexual. But we make that connection in our minds sometimes. This happens in the whole area of personal habits. And when we look at the way we raise children, you brought this up, it's very classic. We learn, for example, that boys don't cry. Very early on, if you're a boy in the society, you learn that you don't cry. Our girls learn you don't swear. There's a whole bunch of different things that are appropriate for girls to do and appropriate for boys to do. And then when we see a boy or a girl doing things that aren't appropriate for them, we again, it clicks into things and makes them suspect they're not conforming.
Yes. One time, one of my kindergarten classes, I was 5 years old, child, single mother, and she went for a concert. She was very good.
Yeah, that, I don't know if everybody could hear, but the fear that since a young boy liked to play with dolls, liked to help in the kitchen, this meant that he might be homosexual, develop into a homosexual. And usually what happens then is rather than recognizing that children have a diversity of interests and allowing them to choose and develop those that are interested, we try and channel them into what we think of as being appropriate behavior for that gender. Interesting, my brother and I both, I come from a family with four sisters and there are two brothers. My brother and I both play with dolls a lot with our sisters, and he's a happy heterosexual and I'm a happy homosexual. We both play with dolls, we both seem to have gone our own way. But there is a strong identification, and what happens then is when we see habits that we associate with being masculine and feminine being done by the quote wrong gender, people oftentimes use that then to accuse people of being homosexual or heterosexual. Or we use the fear of homosexuality to try and cure people from that. You don't want people to think you're a homo. If you play with dolls, they will.
I remember 20 years ago that I told a woman who was married in the process of breaking up, and I'm ashamed to say this, but that because of the reaction of her son and some of the behaviors that he was demonstrating,
very strong identification.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of different things going on there. One is, again, the basic bottom line, it's not acceptable to be homosexual, therefore do anything you can to prevent someone from being that. But then also the whole association behaviors that we have made with what it means to be homosexual. Well, just a few other things. We do this in the social or domestic sphere as well. A classic thing, women work in the house, men work around the house. If you switch roles on that, it's suspect oftentimes. Increasingly, thank goodness it's no longer the case. You oftentimes see men in the kitchen and women doing yard work. But for a long time, it made that strong. And what it is people who can tolerate that diversity tend to have very low levels of homophobia. People for whom it's very important to maintain those distinctions oftentimes also tend to be highly homophobic. This is also seen particularly in the whole role, notion of authority, that the father is the head of the household, unquestioned. People that operate out of that framework also tend to be highly fearful of homosexuals or homophobic. I think I'll pause here at this point before we go on. What I've listed here are a couple of different things, both for the church and the question of AIDS. I'd like to talk first about the church, and then we have time to bring up the question of AIDS, because I know people have a lot of interest in that. And I think unless we deal with homophobia, it's impossible to deal with AIDS. But let's just stop here and just see if there are any questions on this, or if people have the experiences where they can identify with some of these things. Yeah.
When you just mentioned that, I was trying to think about we're all prejudiced and homophobic.
Sure.
And so what my feelings are. And of course, first of all, you're the first gay person I've ever met. I'm sorry, I got a bad background.
At least the first open is
open.
From there.
Well, I know, I do.
Sure.
I suspect some people were, but they never wrote that. But isn't it, so one thing I think is a fairly unknown. You might project, you might talk to like Jesus, the top hater, and read, dirty gaps or something like that. Mm-hmm. So the unknown is one fact.
Very much.
And another fact, I think, there was the fact that males, and I think a male difference, not a female difference. Males typically have fewer friends than females, intimate friends, male friends. And in fact, from the time you're a child, you're taught to compete.
Mm-hmm.
With sports, with business, I guess, you're also had to beat the other guy. And so the idea of actually being even as a more than a friend with a couple other males is kind of foreign. And to the intimate, it's extremely foreign.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
this is, you see this in the animal world too, like flocks of animals. I mean, you see one male with a flock of females,
mm-hmm.
and they fight to death. It's kind of a piece of one male, you know? This is part of the, you mentioned this, but I think that's part of it. So.
Yeah, it's, I think it's definitely part of it. And I think what happens is that's where oftentimes the hostility against gay people is manifested. Particularly, very interesting, I think that there tends to be more outright hostility against gay men oftentimes than lesbians. And I think this has a lot to do with the intertwining of homophobia with sexism. The point, the attitude that you brought out, that men are supposed to compete with other men, and that's just the way the world is, so to speak. Well, gay men should propose another model, which is men loving men being in mutual relationship with men. That seems very threatening, oftentimes, to men who have been taught that the only form of being in relationship with another man is to compete with him. And so there's a lot of times hostility about that. The other thing is where it gets mixed up with sexism a lot is that there's this whole notion, for example, if you're not being domineering, then you're being dominated. And this either-or mentality, and men are the ones who are supposed to be in charge, and women are the ones who are supposed to be passive. Well, homosexual men challenge that again, because, for example, when they have sex relations, one is passive. That is seen as traditionally the passive role, the receptive role. That is seen as, in many cases, as taking on the role of the women, and is seen as, again, threatening the whole idea that men should be in charge, men are superior, and should be active and dominant. And so gay men, by the very fact of who we are, threaten that and become real objects of hostility towards that. They've done some very interesting studies in terms of how homophobia manifests itself in different styles of gay men. And interestingly enough, they have found that effeminate gay men who act in ways that are traditionally called effeminate are less threatening to male heterosexuals than so-called masculine gay men. And what they've discovered is that many male heterosexuals can deal with a feminine gay man because they're so different. They just say, well, if that's the way he has to be, that's fine. I don't have anything in common with him, that's just the way he is. But it's very threatening when all of a sudden they see someone who is like themselves in every way except that he loves men instead of women, and that begins to challenge everything about him, and tremendous feelings of anxiety and hostility can come out of that. So the kind of social conditioning we have that you brought up here, why do men have fewer friends than women? Why are they less intimate? The kind of social conditioning that then is what gay men trigger in terms of anxiety and fear, and I think it triggers the hostility. Jim, you were going to do something about that? Okay.
Yeah. Well, another point, too, that you didn't mention, too, that men do go to near a funeral. I would never touch other men, but handshaking. There's no hugging out here.
Right. And again, that's a cultural or social conditioning thing. It's not something we're genetically born with, not the inability to touch other men, but it is something that's very foreign to us. And it's one of those areas, and that's why it's helpful to identify them so that we can begin to see why things seem strange to us. And I've had this experience a lot, but I have some very close heterosexual men friends, and it's been a long process where we've learned to be able to touch each other and express our intimacy without them fearing that I'm going to sexually assault them, without me fearing that they're always thinking I'm going to sexually assault them. It's been this long process of learning to trust each other, and yet the kind of depth and intimacy that we built up. I have a number of heterosexual male friends who say, I wish I could have this kind of friendship with my other heterosexual men, but we're so threatened by it that we don't allow ourselves to. So that's an area, what I mentioned before, the contributions, I think, lesbians and gay men. I think we can help ourselves to broaden our models of relationships. So I think it's very, very sad that men cut themselves off from other men in deep, intimate friendship.
It's
very cultural. Yeah, there's other cultures in the world where it's not that way at all. Yeah. When they look worldwide at the attitude towards homosexuality, the areas of the world that have the highest degree of anti-homosexual feelings tend to be the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. The Jewish, Christian, or Islam, the Western religions that came out of that Fertile Crescent. If you look at some of the other religions, such as Buddhism, some of the Indian religions, the Native American religions, for example, was just the opposite. I was reading some of the Native American spirituality, and one of the people was saying, I just don't understand the hang-up Christians have about homosexuals. We don't have a word in our society for homosexual. And yet there was oftentimes the role of the shaman or the counselor to the chief was set aside for homosexual people because there was a recognition that they had gifts to bring. So there are many other societies that are far less repressive or critical. There are also societies within the Western world that are different than the Northern European United States kind of model. The Mediterranean societies of Italy or Spain or France or much of Latin America, it's much more allowed, for example, for men to touch each other. And so there's different expressions of male intimacy that are allowed there that aren't allowed in our society. But there has been traditionally a much stronger taboo in the Western religions than that in the societies that are where they've been dominant. Is that the kind of thing you were seeing up into?
The issues you raise are certainly very complicated, and that's the only thing that I would assert absolutely is that there are no absolutely simple answers or explanations in dealing with these issues. But your discussion today raised a lot of new sort of areas or aspects that we need to consider the issues of homosexuality. And I think it's helpful when considering the psychological aspects of the problem that we can be free from the sort of question of whether or not, you know, homosexuality is an obstacle to God's love or should be the basis for excluding somebody from the community or denying them assistance or things like that. If we take away all the aspects of moral approbation, then I agree with you that it's time that we did that. I think that still leaves a lot of questions open. Now, one of the things that I thought was most important is that we begin to talk in terms of psychological
Freudian ideas of explaining the behavior of heterosexuals without being willing to accept the Freudian account of the sexual development of all people, mm-hmm. heterosexual and homosexual, sort of like, you know, rejecting Newton's law of gravity while wanting to play basketball, mm-hmm. because these simply are Freudian ideas. And if repression, the mechanism of repression, the phobic reactions are things that are manifest in the behavior of heterosexuals, the same is true of homosexuals. And I guess one question I would raise, one area that I have difficulty with in this sort of new institution of the homosexual and emerging rituals in our society of coming out and so forth, is that they seem also to rely on sort of when I want to have your cake and eat it too, disputing taboos and prohibitions, and then once you get to, you know, questions of phobic reactions and repression, we say these things only apply to heterosexuals, and my own sexual nature is a simple root back, it's genetic or Resorting to some other simple explanation. Well, the bottom line that makes this interesting to homosexuals would be to say that I feel that sort of response ultimately feeds into the repressed attitudes of society. Because the basic Freudian tenet is that we're all creatures of plural desires. There's no such thing as any person being motivated by a single desire in any direction or other. It's all aspects of cultural conditioning, early childhood development, and so forth. But all other things aren't equal in that, you know, because heterosexual activity enables us to reproduce. Human society, like all other populations, has built into it rewards for heterosexual activity that are never going to be available for homosexual activity because, it's a fact of nature, as you should say. So as far as encouraging somebody to look at which of their desires are repressed, which aren't, I think all other things aren't equal. It's not simply arbitrary. But I applaud your use of these concepts, and I hope that that they gain greater currency.
Let me respond to a couple of things that I'm not sure I'm hearing exactly what you mean. If you're hearing me to say that all of these things I've listed are exclusive property of heterosexuals, then I've misspoken. Every single thing that I've said here, I think, is experienced by all of our population, of all of our society, both heterosexual and homosexual. There are some differences in the way that our behaviors manifest them because, for example, homophobia experienced by a homosexual person tends to be turned inward oftentimes, and we express, and it comes out of self-hatred. Some of the most homophobic people you will ever meet are closeted homosexuals, and they are people who have taken all these societies and turned them inwardly. And so some of the people who tell the nastiest fag jokes will be most adamant about never letting homosexuals do anything.
Well, actually, I didn't mean it's just that homophobia, okay. Homophobia occurs within homosexuals and heterosexuals. I meant to say that all kinds of phobias,
sure,
about related to sex particularly occur within both heterosexuals and homosexuals, that repression occurs within homosexuals as well as within heterosexuals, and that, if we have to consider whether or not heterosexuals have phobic reactions to various aspects of homosexuality, we'd have to consider whether, for example, male homosexuals have phobic reactions to various aspects of female sexuality.
Sure. Oh, yeah. So I agree with you 100%. And I also, I want to always try and be moving us away from an either-or way of looking at things by, this is one of the things that's hardest to communicate sometimes, is people understand. Oftentimes when we as lesbian gay people affirm our sexuality, people hear that as an attack on heterosexuality. That somehow what we're saying about being homosexual as being valid makes heterosexuality being less valid. And that, I think, it still operates within a very much an either-or. One has to be superior, one has to be inferior. You won't hear me saying anything to denigrate heterosexual love or orientation because I think it's a wonderful gift to humanity. But that doesn't mean that it doesn't mean it's the only gift. And so when I hear you talking, it sounds to me like you're hearing me attacking heterosexuals as being the only people who have phobia, and that homosexuals need to look at ourselves. If that's the way I'm coming across, then I'm not speaking clearly, because that's not what I'm trying to say. I'm saying that homophobia is a societal phenomenon that all of us are ingrained in, that I think leads to very destructive behaviors. And most of the victims, the most explicit victims of it, are gay and lesbian people. But certainly, I think heterosexual people are also victimized by homophobia because of what it does to our relationships, what it does to our ability to love other people. So my argument is that for the sake of society in general, my particular concern is the gay and lesbian community, that's my concern, community, but for the whole society, I think we really need to examine what are the attitudes that lead to homophobia, what are the assumptions there. I think we'll all be healthier for it if we can get past it. I don't know if anybody else has examples or thoughts that came to mind as we were talking, or questions?
I have a question that came up when we were talking about some of the fears about playing with dolls and things like that. And I wonder if we kind of presented this, if you have presented this as sort of a spectrum of people who are very strongly heterosexual in their orientation, to people who are very strong homosexual in their orientation. Obviously there are some people who are in the middle, are there studies that do give us some guidance to what influences the people that are somewhere in the middle of that spectrum to get inside the door in one direction.
Yeah, and this is where I think it is helpful. In some places, it is not helpful to make a distinction between orientation and behavior, because it tends to be arbitrary, and people say, we accept you for being in homosexual orientation, we can't accept your behavior. But this is one area where I think it is helpful to make a distinction between orientation and behavior, because there are, I think for people who are caught somewhere in the middle, in terms of what their natural orientation would be, the societal message is so strongly planted towards heterosexual being acceptable and homosexual not being acceptable that most of those people will probably channel their energies into heterosexual relationships. And I think that the reason that you have a 10% minority or so that are strongly homosexual who just find that's not an option, that it's not even an option for us.
If the people that far into the spectrum, isn't it also true that someone the other night was very worried about homosexuals adopting a child and raising a child, and that would have a horrible impact? So haven't some studies been done in that area pretty much?
Yeah. That's one of the most important things, I think, also. And then when we get, I want to talk a little bit about the contribution of the church. In terms of when our sexuality is somewhat fixed, there can be some variation in your life, but most of the studies now are showing that a child's sexual orientation, by the time the child reaches 3 or 4, at the latest 5 years of age, is pretty well set for life. And that has some real important implications for us in terms of how we then structure that child's education and other things. The other thing is that the question is out on sexuality in general, whether heterosexuality or homosexuality, as to what causes it. There's a strong debate as to whether it's biologically fixed, whether it's sociologically, and it's a part of the social environment. The most conclusive studies at this point seem to...